Right, welcome everyone. Thank you for turning out on what is a horribly cold London winter's night. It's not very important, but my name is Toby Dodge and I have the privilege of teaching in the International Relations Department here at LSE. But much more importantly, I'm joined by two friends and colleagues who are celebrating the new edition of their book. To my right is Chris Alden, who's a Professor of International Relations in the International Relations Department and the Director of the Global South Unit at LSE, which is going from strength to strength. And he was former Programme Head of Global Powers in Africa at the South African Institute for International Affairs, the joint author of this, which we'll get to in a minute, but also the South and World Politics, China and Latin America, China in Africa, and co-editor of China Returns to Africa and Japan and South Africa. To my left is Amnon Aran, who we're very proud to say did his PhD at the London School of Economics and was here as a fellow and joined City University, the Department of International Politics, in 2009 and is a senior lecturer. His publications include Israel's Foreign Policy Towards the PLO, and he's published in the Journal of Strategic Studies, International Affairs and International Politics. We are here, as I said, today to celebrate the second edition of Foreign Policy Analysis, New Approaches, written by Chris and Amnon, and I'm a little bit worried because the first edition was so good. It's the recommended text on IR411, the excellent master's course that a lot of you do. I hope you agree it's excellent. So I was worrying when they rewrote it if they'd actually killed the golden goose, as it were, but I'm sure it'll be excellent, and we'll find out today. So both of these gentlemen will speak for about 20 minutes, and their job is to persuade you to part with the remarkably small sum of money that this book costs, and then we'll throw it open to questions and answers and debate from the audience. And Amnon, I think you're starting.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Toby, for that kind introduction. Thank you all very much for coming at what is approximating zero or sub-zero temperature. I suppose what I want to start really with is to say a few words about where this book really came from and what is its intellectual backdrop, both the first edition and then subsequently what we reworked into becoming the second edition. And I think the sort of core attempt of this book was really to engage with, but also advance a very broad literature, which we in the book termed as traditional FPA. And this traditional FPA, or traditional foreign policy analysis, has really been in conversation with a variety of international relation theories since it began its interventions back in the 1950s, especially with realism, but not only. And what we sort of found out when we looked again at the literature is that, A, there were some thematic concepts that we wanted to introduce that were not there in FPA, and there were also some conversation with some strands of IR, which FPA had simply ignored, and we wanted to bring those into the book as well. And hopefully we've been able to do that. Now, obviously, there are sort of two broad assumptions that run in FPA and focus on one particular theme, which was, I think, perhaps the most significant challenge of FPA to IR theories, and that relates to our favorite subject matter of the state. And in this context, really, FPA managed to rebuke, I think, two really important assumptions that up until FPA interventions were quite prevalent. One is that the state is this sort of well-organized unitary unit. And here, of course, through the literature of people like Graham Allison on bureaucratic politics and others, FPA has shown, I think very forcefully, that actually the state often fragments, sometimes into its various or separate bureaucratic fiefdoms. And another assumption, which I think unfortunately is sometimes still very prevalent, at least in the public debate, is that somehow foreign policy is governed by rationality. And certainly the literature on human psychology, which I suspect will be reinvigorated after the most recent elections in the United States, certainly was able to show, at least, that human psychology itself, processes of cognition and so on, at least compromise this sort of image that states act rationally, they have well-calculated interests, and so on and so forth. So FBA was really effective in unpacking what we call this sort of black box of realism. But what we found out when we looked a bit deeper was that it also lost something quite significant. And that was that it unpacked the state, but it didn't sort of replace the realist conception of the state with anything substantially different. And let me give you a few examples. So if I mention again this literature on individual psychological effects, this literature essentially sees the state as the sum of its individual parts, the decision makers, and that is that. So where's the institutions, where's bureaucracies, where's the military, and so on and so forth. Then if you move a bit further, the notion of bureaucratic politics hopefully could save us from that, but it doesn't, because what happens is that the state ultimately collapses into the sum of its sort of competing fiefdoms. So that doesn't help us a great deal either. So what we sort of saw is that FPA really lost sight of the state, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that is in and of itself problematic. So let me try and convince you that actually it is. First of all, it's problematic because if we are focused on the study of foreign policy and we don't have even a basic concept of what is arguably the main actor that actually, where decisions are actually made, and then subsequently the actor that normally is responsible for implementing foreign policy, then it's very difficult to fully account for how foreign policy is determined, and certainly very difficult to say how it is implemented. And Chris will probably touch on this later on. But secondly, what we also saw is that this sort of loss of sight of the state also echoed a very powerful discourse that perhaps emerged in the 1970s in the work of Kyohei Nanai, but then was certainly reinforced by the end of the Cold War in the form of this great debate on globalization, which very much originated also from the LSE by people like David Held and Anthony Giddens. And what was prevalent in that debate was the argument that the state is either withdrawing or transforming or somehow extinguished by the great forces of globalization. And looking very deeply, both empirically but also conceptually, we, not only we, but also other people, Justin Rosenberg, for example, felt that this narrative that the state was somehow withdrawing, transforming, extinguished was quite fundamentally wrong. So against this sort of backdrop, intellectual but also I would say conceptual, one of the main aims of the book was really to try and solve the problem of the state in FPA, and this is how we sort of termed this intellectual lacunae. And here this brings me to the sort of broadening up of conversations with other strands of IR. And what FPA has done very well is bring literatures from psychology, from administrative studies and others. But there was a very interesting debate in IR coming from historical sociologists, people like Anthony Giddens, people like Charles Tilly, people like Fred Halliday, and subsequently people later on like John Hobson, that actually were bringing into international relations a rather refreshing concept of the state. It wasn't the black box of realism, and on the other hand, it wasn't this collapsing state that FPA has been using over the years. And this discourse was really grounded in a very simple idea, that states are actually, to use the seminal definition of Theodore Scotchbull, are a set of administrative, policing, and military organizations that are headed and more or less well coordinated, by an executive authority. Okay, so the state is actually a set of institutions, not a black box, but also not something that collapses into its various parts. And really, this was our starting point for trying and developing a sort of organizing conception of the state in FPA, which really tries to distinguish between three proto-states, which is what I want to spend a bit of time on now. So the first proto-state that we laid out, if you like, was what we called in the book the institutional state. And I suppose that institutional states are the closest example that we could find, at least, that resemble Max Weber's notion of the modern nation state. So they have a set of institutions, but more importantly, these states have some kind of relative autonomy. They have an autonomy from society, and they also have a relative autonomy from other states with which they interact in the international system. Now, they don't have outright independence. States can't do what they wish, but they have this a space, if you like, of a relative autonomy. Now, these institutional states that really resemble the modern nation states we found, why is it interesting to talk about them, and why is it interesting to juxtapose them with other proto-states? The interest lies really in an attempt to foresee or at least discover patterns that correlate between the type of institutions that determine a state and the type of foreign policy that we may expect them to pursue. So these institutional state, for example, which are really the epitome almost of the modern state, usually use the traditional modern instruments of foreign policy that accompanied the rise of the nation state historically. So here we can think about modern diplomacy, of course, personified, if you like, by the institution of the ambassador. Obviously, these modern states tend to use or exert military force to pursue various aims. And of course, they use economic instruments, either to consolidate their relationship with other states or sometimes to impose sanctions and try and change foreign policy behavior. And of course, they're quite addicted to this very famous idea of the balance of power. This is something that we found quite common with these institutional states. And one, I think, subsystem that exemplifies these type of states very well is Middle Eastern states, at least those that have survived the various invasions and implosions and civil wars. If you look at countries like Turkey, like Israel, even Qatar, countries like that, Saudi Arabia perhaps, these countries are quite interesting in the sense that they perform quite close to what we called institutional states. Now, on this sort of spectrum, which is really, if you like, defined by the institutions that state possess and their institutional framework, on the other side of institutional states are what we called in the book, following people like Robert Jackson, Christopher Clapham, quasi-states. Now, these quasi-states, of course, have a very different institutional makeup. That institutional makeup is usually partial, or even it's non-existent. Which means, of course, that quasi-states don't have the kind of material capacity that their fellow institutional states possess to shape the foreign policy environment in which they operate. And therefore, the foreign policy tools that they actually have available to them are very, very different. They include, firstly, how strong are the links that the respective regimes in these quasi-states can form within this sort of broader notion of international society, and particularly with the very elites that are responsible for sustaining international society at any given moment. And in this context, the ability to mobilize networks of support from elements in global civil society, but also from global uncivil society, would be highly important in how these countries implement their foreign policy. So at the very sort of extreme of this spectrum of quasi-states, you will find countries like Somalia during its civil war, Afghanistan during its civil war, Lebanon, and so on. And while these countries, of course, existed in a legal sense, they were all recognized as sovereign nation states legally, their institutions were fragmented, incomplete, and sometimes collapsed. And of course, within this broader label of quasi-states, you will find countries that have an institutional capacity that is slightly better upheld, but nonetheless is still very partial and incomplete. And therefore, the interesting question that arises here is, from what sources do these states actually derive their standing and strength? And here again, there is quite a significant difference from institutional states, in that quasi-states derive their standing from institutions, but also very significantly from international norms, and from two norms in particular. One, of course, is sovereignty itself, which is enshrined in the UN Charter in Article 2, and the second one is the right for self-determination. And with all the imperfections, these two norms at least have been able to prevent the kind of long-term occupation that we saw during the age of empire. Now, the third type of state that we lay out in the book is what we both developed and call clustered states. And clustered states also relate to broader processes of globalization that I will talk about in just a moment. Where we saw clustered states emerging from is really from the Cold War, but not so much from the competition between the two great powers, the Soviet Union and the United States, But rather, clustered states emerged from something that was happening inside what was called the so-called West. So obviously including North America and Western Europe, but also the extensions of the West in the Middle East, in Latin America, Asia, and so on. And what happened in this internal dynamic was that we saw a very slow but nonetheless consistent evolution of a political, economic, military, and even a legal design that underpinned a very wide and complex institutional framework of this so-called West. And just to give some practical examples that might sort of unpack this rather convoluted concept, this institutional framework includes, for example, political military organizations like NATO, economic institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which were actually established by the United States as Cold War instruments, and even a developing structure of global legal enforcement, which was rudimentary but nonetheless began to emerge, such as, for example, the International Criminal Tribunals. And last but by no means least, this sort of very complex and wide institutional complex was also held together by a set of bilateral and multilateral alliances. And this developed throughout the Cold War inside the so-called West. Now, the interesting fact for us, going back to this idea of state and institutions, was that these clustered states developed a very interesting tendency, which was to pool some aspects of their sovereignty and some aspects of their authority in regional and in sometimes global frameworks. And what was interesting is that they did so voluntarily. They were not necessarily coerced to do so, but in the context of this internal dynamic in the Cold War, many of these clustered states ended up pooling some of their sovereignty voluntarily within regional and global frameworks. And this, of course, has very interesting implications for how clustered states then perform in terms of their foreign policy. And of course, despite the very profound tensions that it currently faces, the EU is probably still the best example of a clustered state, which involves a group that emerged in this context and, of course, expanded since 1992. First of all, what is interesting about clustered states is that they have a tendency, more than institutional and quasi-states, to, I would say, conduct their foreign policy in a multilateral fashion. Okay, and they do so on a variety of issues: economic, security, environmental, and so on. And they frequently use, to that effect, regional or global institutions to pursue their goals, and also normally, if not perfectly, try to adhere to international law. And this is something that holds them together. The other interesting feature about these quasi-states is that this predilection to a multilateral foreign policy also significantly complicates foreign policy decision-making processes. Because if we go back to Robert Putnam's famous conception of diplomacy as a two-level game, these clustered states actually have another layer on top. So they have the domestic, they have the bilateral, but they also always have a multilateral facet to their foreign policy decision making. So by nature, their foreign policy decision process is slower and more complex. And as I said before, I think that the European Union exemplifies this type of foreign policy approach and foreign policy decision making process quite clearly. Now, on the back of this notion of the quasi-state, let me turn to say a few things about globalization, which of course is part of this talk. One of the things that we try to, if you like, come out of with this book is to try and offer some sort of understanding of foreign policy under conditions of globalization. So if foreign policy is pursued by these different proto-states, let me now say something about globalization. I'll start by saying that in the book, I think we conceive of globalization very differently from mainstream globalization theories, which, as I've already said, the LSE had a great deal in developing. People working here like Anthony Giddens, like David Held, and others really developed a very exciting debate here during the 1990s and the early 2000s. And what this debate was essentially about was that globalization emanates from one of two things, to put it very crudely. One approach was that globalization really is the product of rapid new technological change and of economic markets. Those were the forces driving globalization, and they were unsettling international politics and driving states almost to oblivion. This is what people like, for example, Kenichi Ohmae used to mention in the early 1990s. And then there was a second argument about globalization, that it wasn't so much economics or technology. These were only the symptoms. Rather, and this is where David Held and his colleagues really came into the picture, globalization emanated out of a radical transformation in time and space. Movement, generally, of people, of goods, of information, of money, was happening more extensively, it was more quick, it was more intense, and therefore it had a huge impact. Now, what these two sort of approaches to globalization had in common was that foreign policy was almost extinguished. Foreign policy, being a political activity, was at the mercy of either the economy and technological change, or to this radical reorganization of time and space. So not much work left for foreign policy analysts, and we can happily retire if you can afford it. But when we sort of reworked and looked back into the literature, and here we used quite a lot of stuff taken by people like Michael Mann and Martin Shore and Ian Clark, we actually came out with a rather different view, which is tied quite closely to this notion that some states are clustered. And this view really sees globalization, again, as something that actually emanated first and foremost and was driven by the political and military processes of the Cold War that pooled some aspects of state sovereignty. And only on the back of that pooling of sovereignty, we could then develop the kind of global institutions, and we saw the expansion of social and cultural relations in the speed and in the scope that we did throughout the 80s, 90s, and obviously into the 2000s. Now, this notion of globalization, that this is an essentially politically military engineered process and is held on particular political arrangements, has quite significant repercussions for contemporary international politics. Particularly given the unprecedented challenge to this Cold War order that is coming from two different directions. One, of course, is this quite significant surge of nationalism personified in the US by the election of Trump, in this country in Brexit, and of course in a variety of right-wing parties in Europe. And from a different direction, the very profound dissatisfaction and protest of working class and lower income earners in the West to the sort of global economic order that has materialized on the back of this Cold War, very slow Cold War evolution. And of course, one of the things that will then determine, if you accept our account, what will be the scope, the future scope of globalization, what will be its future trajectory, that of course depends on what type of foreign policies states will pursue, particularly the big states like the United States and like China. So foreign policy here is both shaped by globalization, but also shapes globalization itself. So therefore, given this sort of profound role that we think, at least, foreign policy will have in determining globalization, we're quite optimistic that FPA will have a central role in deciphering this process. And on this optimistic note, I think I'll pass the baton to Chris. Thank you.
Thank you. First, I'd like to acknowledge my colleague, Professor Margot Light, who played such an important role in foreign policy analysis, both at this institution and more generally. And all of us have been influenced at various stages in our career by Margot's work. I'm going to talk about foreign policy and identity, and if there is time, I'll also discuss something about foreign policy and implementation. So what I'd like to do is suggest that the role of the state is resurgent, It's reflecting the politics, the contemporary politics to which we're about which we're all familiar, be it the Brexit phenomena, the rise of Trump, nationalism in other settings, is something that we had not too long ago thought was dissipating or at least being dampened down. And in fact, the state, as to build on what Amnon is saying, is a significant player. In this contemporary story, it's nationalism, identity politics, and nationalism that I think are especially important and relevant. So let me speak to one of these themes, which plays out in our new edition here. National identity is, following David Campbell and others, continually being remade through the foreign policy process in the form of a series of authoritative declarations and substantive actions. If it's understood in this way, it reinforces the notion that, and I'm quoting our other colleague, William Wallace, foreign policy is about national identity itself, about the core elements of sovereignty it seeks to defend, the values it stands for and seeks to promote abroad. Judah Wells points out that far from being derivative of the international system, national interests are formulated within elite circles and their legitimacy is conferred in the process of constructing foreign policy. For some scholars, the formulation of national interest, the sort of source code of foreign policy, is essentially, therefore, a top-down process, one in which elite policies and interests are critical to defining societal norms and identities. For others, however, Lynch, amongst others, suggests that identity is, in this context, is not directly produced by a single coherent set of interests, but rather actors who share collective identities compete within society compete to frame the interests of the collective whole. So foreign policy in this setting is a competitive environment. The process of foreign policy making is a tussle, if you like, between different groups who represent elements within society and seek to use foreign policy as one of the tools of projecting their image or projecting their interests across that. So foreign policy is a terrain of contestation between competing elites themselves and social groupings, alternatively laying claim to the meanings of authoritative state action in the international sphere. For new political regimes, and my focus has principally been on looking at the so-called Global South, or the developing regions, the primary task of government is understood to be how to forge a nation out of the disparate elements that were featured in the previous regime, be a colonial, authoritarian, post-conflict. Constructing a coherent sense of national identity is not only considered important as a basis for successful foreign and domestic policy, we would argue it plays a much more fundamental role in these countries as a key tool for defining the ideational, that is to say, who we are, the spatial boundaries of the state, where we are in relation to others, and the accompanying imperatives to actions, what we should do in our foreign policy. Role theory, which many of you are familiar with, is in some sense provides an enumeration of the foreign policy tasks which emanate from these different ideational positions adopted by states and serves to reaffirm these positions. So we have different roles: bridge builder, ideologue, mediator. These can be held by states and reproduced through their foreign policy action. In other words, they see themselves and their society as representing a particular identity position, and they use their foreign policy to reinforce, communicate to an international audience who they are, but also reverberate backward into domestic society as to what they are, who they are as well. So it plays a sort of dual role in that sense. (Clears throat) Yes, it's one especially relevant expression of the relationship between foreign policy and national identity is played out in the context of newly independent states and nation building. This is conceptualized as a process by which a particular identity, sometimes reflecting the dominant ethnic group, Burman in Burma, conjuring up the banal geographic descriptors, the Sudan, South Africa, is imposed upon various ethnic and other identities that form the residual past of a given state. In any case, engaging in foreign policy is meant to reinforce the legitimacy of the regime of the day through constant reiteration and reproduction of national identity. So foreign policy serves a purpose of reinforcing who we are, what the boundaries of the state is, and then with that come foreign policy tasks. It's interesting if you look at different regions in the world. In the Middle East, Telhami and Barnett talk about foreign policy and identity as make the point that while conventional understandings of the relationship between state formation and nation building seek to derive national identity from an assembly of subnational particles, as they call it, that for states in the Middle East, the aim is to shrink the national imagery from its transnational status, from that colonial heritage of a broader set of boundaries, and bring it within the confines of the state. And my colleagues will know much more about this than I do in the details of it. So it's moving from a pan-regionalist understanding, pan-Arabism might be the starting point, and narrowing it. The task of nation building is about forgetting, if you like, and narrowing those boundaries to a much smaller geographically, spatially defined territory and identity-based one. There's a similarly in Africa we see in the form of Pan-Africanism, a transcendent regional identity, which again, the task of the state is to dismantle that notion and tailor it back, cut it back to fit the needs of the state. Operationalizing changing identities and roles in foreign policy take many forms, but one of the most directly observable is through a state's use of global symmetry. I think global symmetry is an under-examined part of the international stage, as it were. It is the stage of international politics in many respects. It's a device for giving voice to normative concerns and interests of a given regime in power. Itself draws from these and instrumentally aligns these to societal, uses symmetry to align these to societal values aimed at affirming a particular vision of a national identity. States engage in global symmetry to provide an avenue for divided societies in the process of nation building to project and affirm their identity through foreign policy activism. These come at high cost. It's quite remarkable if you look over time how countries that could not afford to nonetheless become hosts, proponents of large foreign symmetry processes they engage in. Why do they do it? Well, they do it. It's part of that binding. It's communicating outward and reaffirming inward as far as the state and identity goes. If you look at and while these conscious projections on the global symmetry stage may be rooted in a particular elite vision of a country's global role and therefore contested domestically, they nonetheless carry resonances that shape the citizens' and elites' understanding of its position within the global stage and the broader international environment. Just to give you two examples, under Mahathir in Malaysia, we see Malaysia assuming an activist position on the regional and global stage, deliberately designed to reinforce selective features of domestic society. There was promotion of modernist Islam, or Mahathir's vision of this, through participation and activism in the Islamic Organization Conference. There was promotion of the influence of the region, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Again, Mahathir became one of the largest and most active players within the ASEAN framework. And then on the global, his desire to strengthen Malaysia as a leader in the global south. He launched the G15 summit process in the 1980s. He funded the Commission on the Global South. He began to reinvigorate as the non-aligned movement was beginning to taper off, and the enthusiasms with it began to reinvigorate that. This three-pronged engagement gave an opportunity to give expression to the normative characteristics of an imagined Malaysian identity, one which Mahathir cohered with Mahathir's vision of a modernist Islamist state leading in Southeast Asia, embedded in a renewed global south. Other examples include South Africa in post-apartheid setting, again, using the chairing of the UNCTAD process in 96, the non-aligned movement in 98, AU to reinvigorate its foreign reorient its alignment to the south, the AU summits on two occasions to situate South Africa within the broader concerns of the continent, the World Conference on Racism, UN Conference on Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia in 2001, to demonstrate domestically that racism and racial institutions still permeated South African society, entrenched historical inequities, but to also convey that there was something called global apartheid, that there was a world of have and have not on the global stage. So communicating across both of these. And then finally, more recently, initially in joining IBSA, India, Brazil, South Africa, a set of democratic, market-oriented states in the global south with aspirations to leadership, and since 2013, hosting in 2013 the BRICS Alliance. So this gives us a sense of the way national identity is mobilized in the effort. Foreign policy is used as an instrument to mobilize national identity, communicate domestically and internationally new agendas, help secure the state and in an international environment. I know time is sort of escaping. I want to say one or two very straightforward things about foreign policy implementation, a complicated subject. So it's always dangerous to say something simple about something complex. One thing that we in our book. We recognize the centrality of decision-making as a centerpiece of all foreign policy analysis, shedding light on the decision-making process as a way of understanding international politics, that by focusing in a parsimonious way on this internal process, we can understand better the outcomes of foreign policy, of state action in the international sphere. If you look at the classic depictions of how of foreign policy process, they talk about decision making and the great deal of elaboration about that, and then they talk about implementation. What we seek to do is we ask the question: why is it that implementation is cast into the shadows? It certainly is important as a process, indeed, as decision making. In fact, implementation itself often demonstrates its own capacity to reformulate policy in its own set of interests, on the interests of the actors involved. We think that a more complete story about the foreign policy process necessarily needs to talk about implementation. It needs to recognize that the implementing agents themselves, for a variety of reasons, reinterpret, some of them banal. They don't understand exactly what the decision makers wanted to do. They're far down the decision, far away from, it's a distance question of distance. They're far away from the decision and the decision makers, so they reinterpret as best they understand the meaning of a particular policy decision and try to apply it in their localized situational context. In so doing, they reinterpret it They lose features that they don't understand. They may put new emphasis on elements that weren't there in the initial process. And in that respect, they are to be understood as part of the decision-making process. Implementation is decision-making. It might be micro-level decision-making, but nonetheless, its ultimate effect and impact is as consequential as the choices that were made in the confines of government at the Capitol or what have you. I think what I'll do is rather leave it at that so that there is some time for questions, and should there be further comments or questions on that comment, we can do that.
Right, thank you. I think that's given us a lot to discuss, a lot to think about, and I'm reassured that the structure of the old book has been updated but not revolutionized, because I thought the old book was very good. So hands up who would like to ask a question. Yes, you, sir.
You refer in the book and now about the realism's black box. You kept referring to the assumption that realism means that the state is unitary and rational. But we know this is just an assumption to make a theory. Everyone knows that not everyone else is rational. We know that mass does not concentrate at home. So you came up with the categorization of state, that it's cluster states, quasi states, and institutional states. So we can rearrange and organize states in different ways. We can say shared democracies, liberal democracies, we can talk about economies. So how? What does this categorization of the state add to FBA that you came up with?
I'll just say one thing is that, remember, the purpose and driver between foreign policy analysis was to change rationality. So challenge rationality. So much of the work that motivates it is to say that rational model is not an accurate depiction. It's a model. That's why we call it a model. And it attempts to incorporate features of that, but it's going to necessarily lose some of the saliency of that. But I'll leave the rest of it.
Thank you. I think that's an excellent question. Well, you have actually two questions there, so I'll try and address both of them. The one is about realism and this notion of the realist black box being only a heuristic. I think that's true, but to a point, because what happened with that heuristic is that it has cast quite a shadow over the discipline of IR. So from maybe what began as a heuristic, it developed into also becoming a theory that aimed to explain international relations in a somewhat parsimonious way. And the second thing, which I think is interesting with what began as a heuristic, is its overspill into the public discourse. I mean, we often still see reporting about foreign policy in terms only of interests. We talk about what does Theresa May want, what does Donald Trump want, and the actual we saw this in this country very much on the debate sort of running up to the decision of whether or not to remain in the European Union or not. Much of the Leave campaign was about, of course, the Europeans will not want to do, for example, revise the agreement because it wouldn't be to their benefit, as if, again, rationality governs it. And you find this very much also in much of the reporting about foreign policy, which centers on state interests. So I think you're absolutely right that in theory, the notion of realism of state began as heuristic, but I think it has cast quite a shadow on the discipline and beyond, and therefore I think it's quite important for us to take the task to rebuke it empirically and conceptually. The second point which you ask about this sort of tripartite classification. First of all, yes, there are many ways to classify states. You can classify them by regime, by their resources, and so on and so forth. I think our decision to do that was really for two reasons. First of all, this goes back to Chris's last point. To integrate the process of an implementation, you have to have a very clear grasp of what institutional capacity is available to states. And much of the process of implementation will depend on the three-partite classification of institutions, if they're partial, if they're standing, or if they're clustered. That I think is the first issue. The second point is also related to understanding the decision-making process structure, which has been much of the attention, or which has devoted much of the attention of FPA. And what we found was that within this context of FPA, and this goes to your question, what does it add to FPA? If you analyze decisions in isolation of the institutional context in which they are taken, Your account, by definition, is partial. So that was one aspect that we wanted to introduce. But the key point, I would say, relates to two other issues, and with this I will conclude the answer. First of all, any assumption that you have about the state, or sorry, any account of a state has to have within it at least an implicit assumption of what the state means. Okay? And what we have noticed, at least in FPA, is that often scholars of FPA do not come explicitly out with that, with what actually guides their assumption about the state that they're looking at. And we wanted to put that in the debate and say, look, our at least informing literature is the notion of institutions, and we now encourage or would expect other foreign policy analysts to come about with that as well. But the more crucial point is the point that I related to earlier in the talk, which is about the relative autonomy of the state. And this is really the crux of the issue. If we're going to look at foreign policy as an activity that has some sort of independent value to it, in other words, not an activity that is derivative of psychological pathologies or of bureaucratic infighting or indeed of regimes, the only place that we could find that accounts for a relative autonomy of the state that gives you some sort of independence to understand how foreign policy is pursued is if you look at state institutions. Any other notion of the state, be it regime, bureaucracy, decision makers, and so on, always implies that foreign policy is subordinated to some bigger, to some other overriding factor. And you lose out this ability to look into what is the relative autonomy of states and how that relative autonomy then determines foreign policy. Now, maybe in the rest of the Q&A, I'm happy to sort of unpack a bit this notion of relative autonomy, but I think I'll leave it for now at the moment, and you can find more of that in the book.
Sure.
Thank you very much. The great 19th century German historian, Leopold von Ranke, developed the concept of the primacy of foreign policy in terms of the historic analysis of the European sovereign states. Do you think that's still a relevant principle in terms of contemporary issues?
Can you repeat your question there?
The great German historian of the 19th century, Leopold von Ranke, developed the concept of the primacy of foreign policy, and his description of his history of European states promoted that idea. He also mentioned the balance of power, one of the oldest concepts in international relations theory. Philip von Gentz and some of the colleagues of Vienna. Well, do you think that's still a relevant concept in terms of these contemporary theories of foreign policy?
I think that these are functions of the nature of the system within or subsystem within which these states operate. And yes, primacy, balance of power, and these sorts of terms can explain the conduct of states. But they aren't the only explanation, and for those reasons, we have turned to an informed policy analysis, a set of explanations derived from interior factors interior to the process of the state. We believe that there is, as Amnon was saying a moment ago, the role of institutions play a significant role in determining the choices that are made. That it isn't exclusively about an undifferentiated sense of the primacy of interests of a particular state, but rather we can find other factors that explain and perhaps better explain why foreign policy pursues one direction over the other. Having said that, I think it is wrapped in terms of the neighborhood. There's a neighborhood effect. I think the neighborhood effect in East Asia right now looks different than the neighborhood effect in Europe, Latin America, a zone of relative peace and calm. And so that notion of primacy plays out more, can have better explanatory value depending on which of those subsystems you look at.
Yeah, I think I'll just add to that. I think this concept of the primacy of foreign policy is still very much prevalent, but I think in a slightly, or I would say in an added context to what von Reinecke talked about. Certainly in the most fundamental sense, we expect of our foreign policy makers, at the very basic instance, at least to ensure the survival of our states, and that is at the very basic level, and the integrity of the state. Now, what is interesting, and this goes back to sort of this different institutional classification that we proposed, not all states actually have the institutional capacity to maintain these fundamental functions. Certainly not in terms of sovereignty. Syria is a very good example now, and I'm sure you could think of others. But what is interesting is that foreign policy also became at least a primary factor, I would say, in two other senses. One, of course, is this mutually constitutive relationship that exists between foreign policy and the development of national identity. And the two feed into each other very closely. And the second one, of course, concerns the relationship between foreign policy and economic prosperity as well. So I think the sort of core interest that began very much, this goes back to realism from von Reinecke, and he's sort of pertaining to this historical tradition of realism, still remains, but also has expanded into these other facets that we explore in the book and that FPA indeed has been interested in over the years.
All right, who's next? Yes, Professor Light.
Thank you. And thank you for the very kind words, please. In support of what you were saying about identity and foreign policy, it's really interesting to look at what happened to Russia immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Because, in fact, a debate arose amongst elites about foreign policy. Precisely in order to answer the question, what is Russia, who are Russians, how are we going to be in the world? So it was actually spelled out that this was the purpose of the foreign policy, the debate about what kind of foreign policy Russia should have. The question I have is to ask you whether you think that the Trump presidency and the Leave campaign, and now the British government, since the Leave campaign was successful, are actually attempting to shift the United States and Britain from being clustered states to being institutional states.
I'm very happily throw that your direction.
Well, thank you very much for that question. I would go even one step further. I mean, I can't obviously say if there is a conscious exercise of trying to shift from this clustered framework to another. But I think certainly from what we're seeing from the US, even more than what we're seeing from the UK, the discussion is very much in that direction. But I think there's just something even more than that. Because obviously the United States has been the key underwriter of this very complex institutional complex that developed during the Cold War. And I think the fundamental question in relation to the Trump presidency is whether a sharp departure from the policies that actually sustained that complex, whether this cluster can actually survive without US leadership. And I think that is, to me, the rise of Trump. I mean, nobody knows how to where this will go, because he has no policy record. So it's very difficult, even if he fulfills 5% of the promises that he made. I mean, let's think of the five big issues: tearing the agreement with Iran, imposing protectionist policies on China, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, building the wall, and deporting millions of people from the US. That is a frontal attack on this clustered framework. Now, can these clustered states survive without US underwriting, I think, is a very, very profound question. I would be cautious from trying to foresee the end result. I think the British government, also because of the relative smaller size of the United Kingdom and because it's far less and its various vulnerabilities to being completely out of this cluster, is approaching this thing a bit more cautiously. But if you judge President Trump and his sort of immediate circle at face value, this combination of challenging the economic order and this surge of nationalism, I think, goes even one step beyond a shift from cluster to institutionalism, but really poses a threat to this whole edifice.
But is it indicative of the failure of clusterism, as it were, or clusterization?
Well, I think that this question of the failure, it depends, of course, who you ask. I mean, for some people, of course, the cluster has been a profound failure, and they have responded to it in numbers. But for other people, let us not forget that President Obama was the president until 4 days ago, clusterism was a great success. And indeed, I'm not an economist, so I would be a bit cautious here, but at least I think there's a case still to be made that the actual perceived failure of clusterism was indeed a failure, and I'll leave that as a question mark. It doesn't change the fact that you have a strong surge of nationalism and of middle and lower income families, which are dead against it, and they want something profoundly different.
Can I throw one other thing in, which is the very geometry argument? I mean, this, there are different stakes, different examples we've talked, be it the United States versus Britain, what have you, have different stakes, capacities, and that's that they bring to bear and what they understand to be the advantages of being part of the cluster or otherwise. And so I think that that features in the decisions that are the foreign policy decisions that that different leaders take and how they approach the cluster that they're engaged in or informative of. And I think this speaks to a larger theme that we try to do in our work more generally is to recognize the variation across states, that, that one of the problems with traditional approaches to FBA is not to give full recognition to the administrative capacities, the different stakes and interests that are there. And we recognize that complexity. It doesn't make it easy, but it was from that point of departure that we sought to write a book that would at least try to integrate some of those features in its theorizing.
I'll just add one more point, which I think is absolutely crucial about clusterism and the other alternatives, which I didn't mention in the talk. I mean, obviously, we're all pressed for time, but I think is important to expand upon. One of the fantastic side effects of clusterism has been also the expansion of peace. Within this sort of cluster, we've seen an unprecedented period of peace, certainly in Europe and in other places. And there's a big question, and this is precisely one of the great effects of pooling sovereignty. You're less likely to go to war. Now, whether this backlash from the US will also affect that, I think, is a fundamental question that we face now.
Yes.
Thank you for the really, really interesting presentation. I'd love to hear a little more about foreign policy implementation. How do you see the role of implementing agents evolving, kind of in relation to how their roles in the past, do you see their roles evolving or changing or becoming greater?
I don't think that implementing agents, the roles have really changed. It's what our understanding of their impact on the policy process. In recognizing it, it begins to lay the conditions, I would argue, for a greater role, that recognition. I mean, if you can see it in, it's interesting how in public administration, FPA doesn't, is again, that sort of hodgepodge. It draws from different disciplines. The work on public administration, which doesn't focus on foreign policy, puts a lot of emphasis on organizational learning, lessons, failure, this sort of thing. There's a recognition that implementing agents do through the very process of engaging with policy and trying to implement it in their micro, at their micro level, are indeed shaping the actual outcomes of that policy. They feed back in some cases, and it, you know, depends on your how you would like to model this. But so I do think what recognizing the significance of implementation does is it enables one to have a more nuanced understanding of where agency resides. It doesn't reside just in the decision-making grouping, but rather it resides in those actors who are seeking to put that policy into play. And that, so I think that's would be the error.
Yes, Gusta. Yes, you.
I have a sort of a conceptual question on the difference between these three different types of states. And it's maybe a bit technical, but it concerns a potential overlap between these concepts. So are you suggesting that these are distinct in the sense that, for example, only states that have managed to become institutionalized states can then cluster? Or is it also possible that partial states can become members of a cluster voluntarily or somewhat coerced?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. There is almost a deliberate overlap in the concept. And the overlap is that this concept is all connected to institutional capacity. That's one overlap. And the other overlap is that this concept also relates to the degree to which sovereignty is shared or not. Okay? So in that, to that extent, these concepts are, there is a degree of overlap. The difference also lies within the same realm. So what we were trying to sort of, our sort of yardstick, if you like, was again built on two elements. One was the actual institutional capacity that states have, whether it's fragmented and incomplete like quasi-states, whether it still conforms with the sort of institutional capacity of modern nation states. And going back to Chris's presentation, in those situations, you're much more likely also to see states trying to bound themselves institutionally, but also in terms of the identity, and that has many implications for FPA. Or are we looking at these clustered states which tend to sort of voluntarily at least shed some of their sovereignty and they're happy to pool it? Clustered states can potentially become pooled, but on very unequal terms. And that is where you find the difference between a cluster of sort of states that began as institutional modern states and then moved voluntarily into, you know, an organization like the European Union, and quasi-states, which I would say exhibit much stronger patterns of dependency. So you would find the differences as well. But there are many ways you could sort of play around with that concept and try to see different correlations for foreign policy or for other types of external behavior.
Sir.
Thank you for the talk. It's very interesting. The title of the talk is The Resurgence of the State in the Globalized Era. And I wonder if there's an alternative reality where we're sort of 60,000 votes in America and maybe a slogan on a bus, where we're actually having the opposite talk, and a bunch of multilateral trade agreements are being finalised as we speak, and a different president is in there, and we've solidified the European Union. Do you see this? Was this a trend that could have been detected in some way, and that there was kind of resurgence of a state before those things happened, or were they kind of almost shock events that took advantage of a number of factors, the fact there was a referendum, etc., that resulted in this? So is it a trend, or is it kind of an anomaly?
Chris, do you
want to? this is looking backward and suggesting. I mean, we can see trend in the sense that we now are linking up a set of events which the roots of which are fairly distinctive. I don't think the Brexit vote referenda was the same thing as drew from the same sources as Trump. However, we're beginning to link those up, and we sort of post facto reinvent this as some trend in a global trend. Where I do see elements, I'm going to take the foreign policy side of this rather than describe international politics in its broader sense. What I do see is that there are contestation between foreign policy, where the state is, and foreign policy becomes an instrument for demonstrating, reconciling, or positioning on these different competing visions of who's. What constitutes a state, who its citizens are, what the tasks are. In that sense, I think that we can say there's a common feature across these, but less so the triggers in each case. I think the triggers are very distinctive. A different electoral system would have produced a different result in the United States, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I actually see that much more as a longer trend. I mean, I think what we called here the resurgence of the state, and we do talk about this a bit more in the book. First of all, if you go back to the 9/11 events, you already saw there quite a powerful state response, certainly from the United States, which had nothing to do with Donald Trump. And I think that moment was quite a significant moment, primarily in the sense that we sort of had this benign also... Well, some quarters of IR had this sort of benign moment where we thought, well, maybe the state is in retreat, maybe we've got humanitarian norms that are slightly more influential than we thought, and then came 9/11, and then came this massive flex of muscles by the United States and the consequence that came with it. Then, of course, we had in 2008 the financial crisis, and lo and behold, the first actor that came to the rescue was the state by nationalizing banking and by taking all types of measures. So the resurgence of the state, and also we're online, it was on the record that we finished the book before Trump, so you know, we can, so that I think clinches the argument. But more to the point, I think, yes, we have been seeing, certainly in the West, a resurgence of the state. Of course, in some quarters in Asia, most notably China, the state never receded in the first place, or at least maybe receded, but it's still very much in place. But nonetheless, I think within the IR literature, we saw, that's how at least I think, at least I saw it, we saw an overstatement of sort of state retreatment and this variety of global forces, information, actors coming in. And I think this is why we wanted to make the point that we made. But to your question, I think the antecedents and the symptoms have been already there for a while. They didn't begin with Trump, and they won't end with Trump, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I just add another, which is the state is being re-legitimized on a new basis, I think. That's part of what we're seeing. It's a narrowing of the constituent components, who it responds to, and therefore out of that. So, but the state itself is quite a flexible. I think declaring the end of the state was a mistake that's made time and time again. It's a very pliable, redefinable entity.
So,
I wonder whether we can link together identity with the structure and notion of the state and international policy, international relations. I'm thinking backwards historically. If you look at the development of the Nazi state in Germany, it's quite clear that the first thing that happened was identity was changed, the second thing that happened was a state was created, and the third thing that happened was an expansionist foreign policy. And the third could not have happened without the second, or the second without the first. If you go back to, say, Hobsbawm, and he talks about the development of the state and the nation in the 18th century, we have created Italy, now we must create Italians. The whole idea of identity is the platform. And when you have a coherent identity, you can do coherent things. Jumping slightly sideways, from my own experience, deciding these doings very hard.
So your question is the sequencing, is that the right way to understand this?
I think that would be right, but the structures of the state and their different kinds emerge from something more primeval, more emotional. Perhaps you can then use Trump and Brexit in that same argument.
I think there's certainly the mobilizing devices of politics that can then fill the institutions, and out of that the agenda emerges, as it were, curtailed and constrained by formal rules, norms of the international system as understood by these new actors. I'm a little ambivalent about one, two, three sort of sequencing like that. But I get your point, which is to suggest that identity provides a source, the source code, as I said earlier, around which a leader can bring forward an institution and a policy agenda ultimately. So that makes sense in a general term.
I'll just add to that. I mean, I think you're right about Hobsbawm, but obviously his sort of account relates to a different age in the evolution of states. I think once states are intact, I think national identity and identity generally fills the function, certainly when it comes to foreign policy, of creating boundaries, sort of what is permissible and what is impossible. But within that boundaries, there's still quite a lot of scope for institutions to come in and individual agency. And I think, therefore, we should be careful of looking at identity as something that completely determines foreign policy, particularly since it's malleable and prone to change. And this is where I think the Hobson's form is absolutely crucial.
I'll take it in a minute, but I'm conscious that I'm taking people all from the front row because I can see their hands twitching. Is there anyone at the back who wants to ask a question? I can't see your hand twitching. Well, I did try. All right, sir.
So, very interested in the discussion. It all seems quite descriptive. I'm just interested to know how much FDA can be prescriptive, or what's right, what's wrong in terms of foreign policy decisions, being something that's not an academic in this field at all. Just an interesting question from my perspective. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to start, Chris?
The normative positions, there are some normative positions that are encoded, if you like, or featured in FPA. One is about better decision making. Better decision making leads to better outcomes. Better outcomes can be read either in terms of state policy, in other words, we achieve our aims more readily. You could look at it from a broader perspective and say the aims are ones that are shared. They're not about the narrowness of a collective, the collective itself and its success, but rather about producing conditions on a global or systemic level. So there are two trends within FPA, which says, you know, this is really about policy sciences more generally. We're there to improve. It's a sense that a positivist intent that we can improve upon what we did in the past if we study it scientifically, quote unquote, and we'll then implement the changes. That reflection that academics do will provide for that. Another is more broadly cast, and it's about, you know, systemic factors. How do we produce longer term effects on an international system that conform with what we understand to be our norms, the moral universe that we share, a universalist perspective?
I think that's a great question, because when FPA originated, so for example, people like Graham Allison, for example, when they began working in the 1960s under the prospect of a potential nuclear catastrophe, one of the sort of normative impulses that pushed them was to try and create a science of foreign policy that could be prospective. But unfortunately, they realized as the years go by that that's a rather difficult exercise to do and almost perhaps impossible. But where I think FPA can contribute, and I think indeed where it has made its perhaps some of its most significant contributions in terms of policy, is to understand how can we mitigate the prospect for actually replicating the same foreign policy pathologies that we always find when flawed decision-making processes unfold. So, for example, you've got aspects like groupthink and how you can address that. You've got questions of how to sort of avoid a bureaucratic competition from actually determining or producing a sub-optimal foreign policy outcome, and so on and so forth. So, you know, certain countries, and I think it's particularly certain decision makers that are actually conscious to these potential flaws, whether they've read foreign policy analysis or not, have a better prospect of, as Chris said, developing much more, I would say, effective decision-making processes, and hopefully avoiding some of the pitfalls and pathologies that actually brought about disasters and foreign policy failures. So that's, I think, where we can contribute. But prescription, I would probably say cautiously.
Now, I have a question for both of you, and I'm going to ask you to predict.
Okay.
Which is always a dangerous thing.
Now, we always do that.
Foreign policy analysis is often accused of being Americo-centric, partly because America offers us the richest and quickest data, because politicians leak, but also the Freedom of Information Act, you get a lot of data. And so we've just had the inauguration of Donald Trump on Friday, and I thought if Zelikow and Allison were here, this great book that sees the president constrained and reduced to the first among equals in her or his cabinet. And so they would, I suspect, argue that Trump, although clearly without foreign policy experience and with a Twitter account that scares the life out of me, is an oddball, an oddity, everyone. But the bureaucracy and the institutions will constrain him. Are they right? Will he be constrained by the most powerful and probably finally institutionalized state in the world?
I think both yes, but I would argue another constraint is his own personality, quite frankly, and that's a very specific response. I think that his attention span will not be sufficient to manage these issues, and the creating and generating new problems that require, in his view, require instantaneously response. Bureaucracies are not well attuned to that kind of thing. He generates crises. I mean, Allison's work is about crisis management and an assessment of institutions in that regard. This guy's going to be doing, you know, a one-man show, just churning it out one after the other. So institutions' response to that will be will not even, they won't be catch up to him in this regard,
so they can't move quickly enough.
Yeah, I just add to that, because I think I'll say two things about that. First of all, in the book, what we've tried to do is actually address one of Toby's the very point that Toby now made, and actually expand. We include quite a lot of case studies in the book, and actually expand them beyond the United States. And that's something we've been quite conscious of. I think the question about Trump is really this. Sort of looking at presidents or prime ministers, I think any prime minister, if you look back, or president, usually has one or two decisions that only they can take. So you have one or two moments where only they can actually, they're the ones that have to take the decision. The bureaucracy will be split, the advisors will be split, and at that moment, the only person who can actually be the adjudicator is the president itself. George Bush, 9/11. It was one decision, and that was it. Cameron with Brexit, and you can look back. So I think possibly in many decisions, he will be constrained by a very complex and dense institutional framework, going back to our original starting point that he in which he operates. But if he will be confronted with one of those decisions, let's hope he doesn't, a chemical attack, one of these big decisions, that's it, all the eyes are on the president, then of course there will be literature on psychology and individual that will probably hold sway more than Alison and the notion of bureaucracy. So I think that's as far as I'm willing to predict, but I'll put that on the table.
Right, we're coming into the end zone. Are there any more questions? Right. I'm going to. Yeah, thanks. I'll come to you. So, but first the woman, and then behind her the gentleman. After that, yes.
Hi. You were talking about the importance of taking implementation factors into account, and I was wondering what your impression on in the world of outsourcing, ramifications of using large consulting firms to actually implement policy to be used.
Mm-hmm. No, good question. I think it. I mean, it reflects a certain era in of the state. The state, the efficacy of a neoliberalism, a smaller state, where you keep your local costs and your local risks low, reduced, and you provide other actors who can either bear those costs administratively, or they can be plausible deniability, if you like. They're at a sufficient distance that you yourself aren't implicated in. Not you yourself. The state itself isn't implicated in that. I think this idea handing over that authority is a very interesting one. It's part of an argument about the state as disparate, as a collectivity without of components and parts. It also is smart politics in a world. It has proved to be smart politics and an engine for globalization, certainly a Western engine for globalization. If you look at, for instance, the German state, which inherited the German party system, party institutions, the FES and others, and is able to project foreign policy interests that are their societies and values that are through a variety of mechanisms that don't necessarily redound back to the state itself, but rather reflect the interests of different political parties. And this very nicely allows me to say something about political parties. I think that's, when you talk about the American-centric nature, that's one of the major failings, I think, of the FPA. Classical FPA agenda is not to give enough import to political parties as sites for organizing interest, for articulating and developing a foreign policy agenda. We do a bit on this here. We admittedly, there's more to be done, but I think just that kind of reorientation, giving political parties more saliency, more agency as actors within the system, I think gives us a nice way of reading the sources of foreign policy action that a U.S.-centric approach would be less likely to provide.
Thank you. Sir, yes, you.
How the geostrategy affects the analysis of the foreign policies? As a geostrategy, I mean resource locations and demography and that potential economical market penetration. By the institutions that the state is.
I mean, it's a very good question. Some of the FPA literature that came up in the 80s talked a lot about states solely in these terms, sort of resources, how much, you know, population, potential economic growth, and so on and so forth. But I think here again, you need to, you know, you cannot see that, if you like, source of foreign policy without juxtaposing it with the institutional framework in which states actually exist. So I would say you have to look at the material endowment of states in conjunction with the institutional framework that we have. And once you've connected the two, then you can start talking about how that translated to foreign policy.
Excellent. Do you want to?
I was just going to say, Kent, in a sense, throwing the question up back at you, but just as a general rhetorical position, is in an era of if we're indeed headed towards 12 billion people on the planet, as some projections suggest, in an era of shrinking resources, what shape will geopolitics take? How will it look in that setting? The classic drivers of geopolitics suggest that, you know, a zero-sum competition over access to these things. So it may be we're seeing the beginning of that reassertion of some classic precepts of geopolitics in the way people think about foreign policy.
Right, the final two questions of the night. You, sir, first, and then just at the back there. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned that a lot of these sort of trusted states formed out of the Cold War, and it's quite clear to me that there's evidence why there would be national self-interest in forming organisations like NATO and the European Economic Community, maybe originally. But do you see that sort of? Do you see a spectrum moving from the sort of institutional state through to the cluster state, and then maybe beyond to an institution which is maybe more? You pull more and more sovereignty, and therefore you sort of lose sovereignty, I suppose, in the sense that you have similar altruistic aims and ambitions. Is that, or is it always self-interested involved in these clustered states, I suppose?
No, I mean, I think, like I said, and this is where we really differentiate from the sort of alternative or complementing theories of globalization. Certainly, self-interest and this broader sort of Cold War competition, if you like, induced the process that then developed into clustering states together. But certainly, once that process was in motion, and certainly this idea of pooling sovereignty, you then had the other layers, economic interdependence, the expansion of social relations, and indeed, going back to this question of identity, this new, at least evolving idea of some Europeans, going back to the idea that, no, we're not distinct countries which had pretty dark histories, we're actually a new Europe. And a new kind of people. And certainly these additional layers have acquired, to a great degree, a life of their own. And hence, Brexit is not a very simple process. So I think it certainly, at some point, you sort of have a tipping point where it goes beyond state interest. The question is, I think, at the same time, is whether these layers, which have developed a life of their own, whether they can withstand, assuming that there will be, the type of onslaught that we might be expecting. And again, this is an unknown at the moment, but I think this is probably an unprecedented period in terms of the threat clustered states face, not so much from Brexit, with all the talk about Brexit, but of course what's happening on the other side of the Atlantic.
And the final question of the night.
Thank you. How do you see the resurgence of the state and the sense of nationalism in Donald Trump and the United States affect non-state actors, specifically international terrorist groups?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, I mean, it's a fairly specific question. If you read, I saw the other day his foreign policy statement. If you go on the website there, and he puts up number one, he gives prominence to fighting terrorism, fighting ISIS, and all of that. So presumably, at least in his mind, he seems to be absent of knowledge of recent history, but if all the efforts that could be put forward by the United States, that he'll do what no one else has been able, and his predecessor was unable to do, and eradicate this particular problem. What will it do? I don't know. I'm in the company on this panel of people who have probably more reasoned views on this sort of subject.
What's interesting about, I mean, I think if you look back from 2001 to now, what's interesting is that both Al-Qaeda and also ISIS have, if you look at the billion-plus Muslims that live around the world, they've had a very low attraction. So despite the talk by Donald Trump and despite, of course, the menace that ISIS poses, the actual attraction in terms of attracting millions of Muslims to join the vanguard and storm the Western world, that has not happened, and not only because of the work of intelligence communities of the West. Simply people were not attracted by it. So I think if you ask me what can a presidency of Donald Trump do if he indeed implements the policies that he said he would, I think that would actually probably do most to boost these sort of vanguard organizations, in the sense that the most zealous one will go anyway. But the question is, what happens to those who are sort of on the borders, the undecided voters, if you like, on the other side? Now, if you've got the United States beginning to deport or really take harsh policies against millions of Muslims in the United States, begin this intensive vetting that he talked about, which, of course, must result in some sort of less cooperation with security agencies in the Middle East and in other places, I think that's a great prospect, actually, for organizations like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, and anybody else who is trying to fuel this. So I actually see this as another very ominous aspect of this potential Trump presidency. But again, he doesn't have a policy record, so we'll still have to see what, indeed, he will ultimately implement from all the things he promised in his campaign.
Well, I think we've been very lucky tonight for three reasons. Firstly, I think we've seen an explanation, an exposition, a defense and expansion of foreign policy analysis, a topic close to my heart, and I think that's been excellent. We've seen two academics at the top of their game explaining that, applying that, and using it to explain international relations. And both of those things are boiled down into an easily readable and very affordable book that I strongly advise you to run out and buy. So let's thank our speakers.